You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Well, wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
This podcast is being brought to you by Voyage AC.
Which is where you want to shop for this year's Mother's Day present.
Wow, is it that time of year again? What are you getting, Linda, your mom?
Well, the 9-inch votive candle is back, so it's so gorgeous. And there isn't a home, apartment, RV, or tiny house that wouldn't look great and smell better with any one of these candles.
And they gift wrap, right?
The most gorgeous gift wrapping ever. Voyage AC is your destination for candles and a plethora of other wonderful, thoughtful Mother's Day gifts like beachwear, diffusers, glamorous masks, face and body products. So how can our listeners find Voyage AC?
You can find everything you need on their website at www.voyageac.com. That's VOYAGEETCIE.com.
And as you know, Melanie is willing to give my friends and family discount to all our listeners right now.
What?
That's 10% off everything you buy.
All you need to do is enter the only one at checkout.
That's right. All you have to do is enter the only one when you make your purchase. Voyage AC is an olfactory journey of candles, perfume, and organic beauty products.
This episode is being sponsored by Cute Booty Lounge.
You mean this cute booty is being sponsored by Cute Booty Lounge.
Honey, I think you might need to buy some more CBL leggings. You wear them like every day, right?
I do. I need more. The problem is there are so many great styles. Mm. I don't know which ones to order. Cute Booty Lounge is made right here in the USA by women and for women. The company is incredible, female and minority owned. And if you're like me, you're in loungewear 90% of the time. Mm-hmm. These are the leggings for you. There's a cute booty style for everyone. No matter where your active life takes you, CBL will comfortably dress you from head to toe. And they fit every shape and size. So whether you're running errands, heading out to the gym, or having a night out, Cute Booty Lounge has you covered. Embrace your body. Love your booty.
And to make it even sweeter, head over to cutebootylounge.com and enter the code THEONLYBOOTY and get 15% off your first order.
Oh, you're going to need to say that again, hon.
I like saying it. Head over to cutebootylounge.com and enter the code THEONLYBOOTY to get 15% off your first order.
Hi, my name is Matthew Cox, and I was the only one inside of federal prison writing true crime stories. I was dead broke in prison, scraping together these stories, but I'd never been happier. So I'm in prison, happy, actually worried about getting out of prison, not looking forward to it, and thinking once I'm out, I'll push the stories. And I thought, if I push them when I'm out, you know, how cheaply can I live? I'll live in someone's spare room. I'll take the bus. This is what I'm thinking. I'm down to nothing. And I'm willing to stay that way because I was so overwhelmingly happy. And I knew getting out and making a bunch of money wasn't going to make me happy.
Imagine being a con man and doing a lengthy prison sentence for a variety of bank fraud charges, and finding that instead of the yard or the track, you feel drawn to the library. Matt Cox, former con man and true crime author, spent years in prison writing stories, starting with his own, and then going on to write the stories of his fellow inmates. But what would you do if you realized that once you were released, the only legal ways you knew how to earn money were now off the table? Would you go back to the life of crime? Or would you embark on a new career and become a legit true crime author? Hi, I'm Laura Cathcart-Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room. In September 2018, I found myself in an all-too-familiar position. Looking around the room at the other attendees at a famed writer's retreat, I realized that I was the only Black woman in the room. When I wrote about my experience for the Huffington Post, something surprising happened. 24 hours after my piece went live, I had 568 direct messages in my inbox. These were messages from people of all races, ethnicities, creeds, and nationalities who had connected with my piece because they too had felt othered. These are the stories we want to share. This podcast is for anyone who has ever felt alone in a room full of people, which is to say that this podcast is for everyone. You're listening to The Only One in the Room, presented by Lipstick and Vinyl and executively produced by Christina Barcy. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to like and leave us a review of your thoughts on the show. And if you have an Only One in the Room story you'd like to share, you can DM us on Instagram at The Only One in the Room. Enjoy the show. So we are talking to Matt Cox today. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing really well. I'm so excited to hear these stories you're going to tell us. But before you do, I had to ask you, I've been thinking about this since we last spoke. What was the first meal you got after you got out of prison?
I actually tried to go to McDonald's and get a cheeseburger, like just a basic kid's cheeseburger, but they were not serving yet because I got released so early. So we stopped at like a 7-Eleven or something, and I ran in and I got ice cream. I got pistachio ice cream.
That actually sounds really good.
Yeah, right. Ice cream and cheeseburgers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was like a month later when I got the cheeseburger.
So what was the first meal you ate after the ice cream?
I mean, that's when I got to the halfway house. It was like a hamburger. It was a hamburger, something along those lines. It was delicious. Anything in the free world is delicious. Like I have yet to have a bad meal out here.
Wow. Well, that is good to know. Thank
you
for that.
Might make a t-shirt, anything in the
free world is delicious. Yeah, you can use that. Well, we'll use it too. Thank you for that. My name is Laura Cathcart-Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room. But I am never the only one in this room because, as usual, my boyfriend, producer, and co-host, Scott Slaughter, who I call Hun, is here as well.
Hi, honey.
Hey, Hun. So I'm going to read this to you. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool. It's from Matt's site. It says, "My name is Matthew B. Cox, and I'm a con man. I recently completed a lengthy prison sentence for a variety of bank fraud-related charges, and I'm 100% guilty of them all. I was incarcerated at the Federal Correctional Complex in Coleman, Florida. It's not a bad place, as prisons go. Some inmates do their time in the recreation yard, walking the track and doing push-ups. Others learn to play an instrument. I spent my time in the institution's library, writing my fellow inmates' stories. Sometimes it was a memoir, other times it was true crime. As a result, I heard an outrageous amount of stories. Some intrigued me and some didn't. I tend to focus on the more unique, clever, bizarre true crime stories."
Very cool.
Right?
I didn't know anybody even did that.
That's why he's the only one, right?
Right? It's brilliant.
It is brilliant. And welcome. Welcome, Matt. We're so glad you're here to tell us some of these stories.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Matt, I always ask our guests how they identify before we start the interview.
How they identify in what way?
Well, that's a good question. I started it because some people may appear to be one gender, but they identify as another. Some people don't sound like their race or their ethnicity. So I just ask people how they identify. But most people kind of go for like their career or, you know, if they are a spouse or a parent or...
I'm a con man.
Yeah. Yeah.
You lead with it. I love it.
Oh, that's so great. Thank you for that identification. So speaking of that, tell me what crimes you were convicted of.
Let's see. It depends. I was charged with certain crimes and some of them they dropped because they were so redundant. So let me think. I have been charged with wire fraud against the United States government. And wire fraud, conspiracy to commit wire fraud, money laundering, conspiracy to commit money laundering, passport fraud, use of a passport, of a false passport. What else? Bank fraud, of course. A conspiracy to commit bank fraud, financial institution fraud, conspiracy to commit financial institution fraud. What else? Identity theft, aggravated identity theft.
Aggravated identity misleading. Theft.
Sounds violent, doesn't it?
Sorry. It does sound violent, yeah.
It was a separate charge that the federal sentencing guidelines allow them to stack an extra 2 years. And all it really is identity theft. But by charging you specifically with that charge, they get to add 2 extra years. So if you, let's say your maximum sentence is 30 years, well, you could get 32 years. So my real original sentence was 24 years, but plus 24 months for the aggravated identity theft. What else was I charged with? Got the password. Oh, government document fraud, social security fraud, which is also misleading. I just convinced the Social Security Administration to issue social security numbers to people that didn't exist. So it makes it sound like I defrauded them, but really I just convinced them to issue a bunch of social security cards. I didn't get charged in the state with, like, I've had 27 IDs and 6 or 7 different states, but I didn't get charged with the IDs. Yeah, I got lucky. What else? Yeah, I'm trying to think. There's got to be some other ones in there.
Well, the big one was that you ripped off a bank for $15 million, right?
Well, it wasn't one bank. It was multiple banks. It added up to $15
million. It was multiple
banks.
Okay.
And the FBI said my mortgage company did $40 million in fraud, but they basically dropped that. They said, because it's almost impossible to say that I was specifically responsible for that fraud when there were so many people that also worked there. And they were saying, well, that I was involved in every single fraud that went through the place. And it was really an estimate. And I was already so doomed to begin with. It was like, yeah, come on. I mean, this guy's already going to get practically 30 years. Are we really going to spend the next 6 months compiling another $40 million? He's already done.
So how long were you in prison?
12 and a half years.
12 and a half years. And you were released in July of 2019, is that right?
Yes. But the first 10 years is the hardest.
10 years.
I'm just joking.
How come?
It's all hard. Usually people say, they're like, 12 years, you know, and I get to say, yeah, but the first 10 is the hardest.
The first
and they
10
think
is
about
the
it
hardest.
And they're like, oh yeah. My God.
All right. That's funny. You told me that you dropped about 40 pounds in
there,
right?
Yes. I think when I went in, I weighed 180 and I got up to 195. And then before I left, I went down to 150. But that was ridiculous. I mean, everybody was telling me, you know, what are you doing? You look sick. You look like you've got cancer or something. I was like, look, I'm going to gain 15 pounds when I get out. I'm 100% positive of that. There's no way around it. So, which is
right.
True because I weigh 165
sure.
Right now.
There you go. Well, you said you were eating just like granola bars and pickles,
yes,
right?
I was surviving.
Yeah. It is. It's like survivors.
Yeah, everybody would say, they're like, you're not going to spend anything on food. You only eat granola bars and pickles. They're like, and they're practically free in the real world because everything's so expensive in there.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's so funny. So you were telling me that the worst part about being in prison was not accomplishing anything. Can you talk about that a little bit?
After I was sentenced, I spent, you know, it's hard to say. So the problem is that you get sentenced, and if you have a short sentence, sometimes a short sentence is actually worse than a long sentence. If you have a short sentence and you have people outside, you tend to focus on them the whole time you're in there. You're desperately trying to still run things and tell your wife and, you know, hey, do this, you got to help do this, you got to do this. You know, tell your kids, you're still trying to be a father. And if you get 10 years and you realize your wife's not going to be there in 10 years and there's, you know, you're divorced and the kids aren't listening to you, you kind of give up on that. And then you just kind of kick back and just realize that I really just have to kind of build a life in here. I'm going to be here a while. And these guys outside aren't listening to me. But I was lucky because it doesn't sound like this, but I didn't have any of that. I didn't have a wife and kids out there waiting for me. I didn't have anyone waiting for me. And other than my mother. And so it was just like, okay, how do you keep yourself entertained until this time is gone? And you read for a couple of years, but then that gets old. And then the worst thing was, is that, what am I doing in here? What's happening? I'm not accomplishing anything. And that was the worst because being in prison, once your expectations are dropped to the floor, you realize I can deal with anything. It doesn't matter. You adapt. Humans adapt, I don't know how quickly it is, but, pretty quickly you adapt to the situation and you're okay and you deal with it. I mean, unless you're just one of these people that want to walk around and complain all the time, but I'm not that guy. I'm going to make the best of any situation.
Right.
So, but the biggest problem was no matter how much of a great routine I could get and I felt good about things and I do this and this and my days would shoot right by, you very quickly, the worst of it for me was I just was not accomplishing anything. I'm going to be in here at one point I thought I was going to be in there for 22, 23 years. And I thought, what are you going to do? You're going to walk out of here at 60 something with nothing and you'll have accomplished nothing. I mean, talk about really ruining your life. I mean, you hear people like, oh, this person did this and they ruined my life. And it's, you're not in a wheelchair. You didn't lose a limb. You're healthy. You lost your job. You'll bounce back. You'll be okay. Your life's not over. My life's gone. I'm going to walk out of prison at 60 years old and I have no retirement. I have no way to plan for retirement. I'm just done. I've accomplished nothing. And that was the worst of it, was like, one, you have ruined your life. And my life's vastly different. Maybe it's not ruined, but I certainly will have accomplished nothing. And there's not much that you can do in prison. Like, you can learn to play the guitar. You can play sports. You can maybe join the leather class. You can paint, very small paintings. And you have to have money to do most of those things I just said. You have to have money. So if you're broke, like I was, you're broke. You have no real money coming in. You're not doing leather craft. You're not painting. You're not drawing. You're maybe joining, maybe you can take a couple of classes, and then it's basically, okay, you can read. That's what you can read, and you can walk the track, and you can play some sports, but the truth is I don't want to learn how to play the guitar. I don't want to play, flag football or racquetball, or I guess it's handball in there. Yeah, I don't want to do any of those things. So those aren't things that interested me on the outside. They don't interest me now. What do you do? And I'd been on all these shows, so everybody kept saying, you need to write your story. And I was like, oh, I can't write. I have dyslexia. It's hard for me to read. It's hard for me to write.
Wait, what do you mean you've been on all those shows?
Dateline did 2 one-hour specials on me. American Greed did a show on me. So everybody was like, they'd seen my story on TV. They'd read articles. I was in Playboy. I was in Fortune magazine. I was in Bloomberg. So they're like, you've got an amazing story. You should write a memoir. So I had somebody sent me in, it literally was like The Idiot's Guide to Nonfiction and like Memoirs for Dummies, which were great books, by the way. Like that whole series where I used to always joke about it. It was like, they're actually amazing books. Like they're written by real people. So I read those and then I started writing my story and I wrote my story. And that took 6 months because I had to order all the Freedom of Information Act. I had to figure out how to do that. And so because I didn't have all the dates and I didn't know what happened while I was doing this. I didn't know what happened. What was law enforcement doing? So you get the Freedom of Information Act and you find out all those things. So I was able to give as close of a version of a 360-degree bird's eye view of what was going on, although it was mostly from my point of view, but at least I was able to say while this was happening, this is what was happening. And so I wrote that and I took my time. There's no rush. And I had a bunch of people read it and guys critiqued it. And eventually it was pretty much done. And I got a literary agent.
Wait, sorry. So you're saying this all very casually, but I mean, I love that you knew to order the Freedom of Information Act and that you started by reading those guides to writing. But how did you get a literary agent from inside prison? Like people from outside prison can't get literary agents.
It had to be 100 letters. And I mailed them off. And what was so funny is I'm in prison. Like I remember thinking, I know this guy wouldn't say this if I was standing in front of him. I mean, 80% of them were form letters. But some of these guys were like, you are an unsympathetic character that deserved every day you received. I mean, it was like they had, and I was thinking, he didn't even read the memoir. He's just going off of, some TV show that he saw. You have to know that American Greed is slanted, although about 90% true. You could have not said that. You know what I'm saying? You couldn't get that. Was a little over the edge. You have to know some of these people are exaggerating. But regardless, by saying that, it always cracks me up because it's like, it was about 90-95% accurate. And I'm like, yeah, but this didn't happen. This didn't happen. I remember one of my buddies in prison, his name's Perry Rossini. He said, yeah, I know, but that's saying, hey, they said I murdered 11 people. It was only 9. And he goes, you're still a scumbag. I was like, okay, that's true. That's true. So regardless of what they said, still a scumbag. And they looked me up. They looked me up on Wikipedia. They believed everything they read. And they just went, no, 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 no. Well, eventually, I ended up getting a literary agent. And he came to see me. And he read the manuscript. And he said, this is an amazing story. And I was like, oh, you know, I was like, wow, yeah. Feeling really good about that. And he goes, this is an amazing story. And at the end of it, when they gave you 26 years, I thought, he looked me in the face. I thought, good, fuck him. He had it coming. And I went, my God. I was like, I thought you wanted to represent me. He goes, I do. I just want you to go back and rewrite the story. And I was like, what? And he said, you never mentioned any of, you know, and he knew he had read a lot about me and he had looked at some things and he goes, you never talk about your childhood. You never talk about this. You barely mention your father. I know something's messed up there. I know. And he started talking to me about it. And then I was like, okay, yeah. I was like, nobody wants to hear all that. He goes, nah, you're wrong about that. And so then he sent me a book on written probably 100 pages about writing memoirs. And I read that and I rewrote my book and I put in some stuff. I still didn't put in a lot of stuff about my childhood, but when it was done and I sent it back to him, he said, I mean, I want you to change this paragraph and this page needs, this needs to be rewritten. And I would stop here and not go on for another 2 pages like you did, you know? And he said, it's perfect. He was like, it's amazing. He's like, I literally teared up at the end. And he was like, and I don't tear up. He said, my wife actually told me to tell you she likes you now.
That's great. We're going to take just a quick break to tell you about a cool new product that Scott and I discovered. And we'll get back to our guest's amazing Only One story in just a minute.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
But at this point, were you telling your fellow prisoner stories yet, or was it just yours?
No. So after I had the manuscript and people were reading it, there was a guy that came on the compound or was locked up in the prison with me, and he showed up, and his name was Ephraim Deveroli. And he had been in Rolling Stone magazine.
Can you tell us why he was in Rolling Stone magazine?
Deveroli was locked up he was in Rolling Stone. It was for arms dealing. He's an arms dealer. He's an international arms dealer. And he was an international arms dealer at 18 years old. He's a Jewish kid from Miami. And he was in Rolling Stone because he had a $300 million. By the time he was 20 or 21, he had a $300 million contract to provide ammunition to the Afghani security forces for the United States government. His story was ultimately turned into the movie War Dogs.
But before it was turned into the movie War Dogs, so you said you met him there. Did you write his story? Was he one of the people that you sought out to write his story, or did people come to you? I don't know how that part worked.
So yeah, it would have been 2015. So by 2015, he showed up.
Okay.
I had already written my story. My literary agent was shopping it. He shows up. We talked a few times. So we started talking. I said, hey, I read your article. And he was like, okay. And I said, you ought to write a memoir. I'm finishing up my memoir now. You ought to think about that. And he's, oh, I couldn't do that. I have ADHD and I'd never be able to focus long enough. And I said, look, man, there, you know, you could probably sell the rights to it. And I said, you could get a professional writer. And he goes, I said, all you got to do is write a really good outline and hand it off to somebody and they could run with it. And he was like, he said, I don't even think I could do that. And I said, well, I could help you with it. He's like, well, why would you do that?
What did you think of him?
I'm so glad you asked that. I always say that Jonah Hill made him look soft and cuddly. And the thing about him is he's just vicious and super conniving is not the right word. Look, he's extremely savvy. He is extremely cutthroat. I wouldn't trust him as far as I could throw him, but he is an amazing businessman. Like he's shrewd. He sees all the angles. He's extremely intelligent, like a hideously, and it's not for the good of humanity. But yeah, he's,
yeah.
So anyway, we talked, and I remember I kept seeing him. He was like, hey, still thinking about it. I'm still thinking about it. And I was like, okay. And then we found out his story, the Rolling Stone story, had gotten sold. And so I walked by, and he's like, hey, man, did you hear the Rolling Stone story got sold? Like, they might make a movie about me. And I looked at him, I said, who bought it? And he goes, the guys that did the Hangover movie. And I looked at him and I go, that's like Scott Phillips or somebody who's right. And I went, you know, you seem like a smart guy. And he was like, yeah. And I went, you're telling me that story from the other guy's perspective in Rolling Stone was sold. You're not going to make any money off of that. It's your story. I said, they're going to make a movie. The Hangover guys are going to make a movie. I said, and it's going to be called Dude, Where's My Hand Grenade? And you're going to be a laughing stock. You're going to be Spicoli. I said, don't you have to go back out and earn a living? And he just looked on his face. And I went, and all you have to do is meet with me twice a week so I can write an outline and you could beat these guys the punch. I said, I mean, you tell me, who do they want to make a movie about? From Packhouse's point of view, Packhouse was an employee. He was a low-level employee. I said, or you're the head guy. And he was like, he goes, when can we meet? So we met. I wrote the outline, spent more time with him than anybody, and we became friendly. And then he asked to read my manuscript. I let him read mine. He came back and he said, look, I want you to write my story. Can you do it? And I said, I think I could do it, but you could get a real writer. And he was like, no, you're a real writer. I remember he said, this is the best thing. And he gave me my book back. He goes, this is the best thing I've ever read. And I was like, really? He goes, absolutely. Now, and you know, to be perfectly honest, you know, I found out later he'd only read about 3 books in his entire life. But still, it was extremely, you know, I felt really good, you know, very flattering for,
yeah,
you know, for the next few days till I found out he'd basically read magazine articles his whole life. So yeah, so I ended up writing a story. I gave him to my literary agent and he left. And then he ended up, got out of prison. Well, he was actually transferred to a camp. I went to the camp in Miami. And then from there, he was released with the manuscript, and I didn't talk to him again. He and the literary agent basically walked away. So they stopped returning calls.
Your literary agent?
My literary agent saw that this kid has got manuscript and he could, you know. Now I talked to him every once in a while and they talked about suing and they talked about this and talked about that. And, you know, the Simon & Schuster wanted to publish the book, but it wouldn't be out fast enough. And they went back and forth. And then they were thinking about self-publishing and this and that. And then the phone calls stopped. Like, they stopped getting answered. I stopped getting emails. Devaroli never spoke with me. And what was so comical about that was months and months went by. And then I remember a buddy of mine came up. There's a magazine called Ocean Drive in Miami.
Glossy.
So a buddy of mine came up to me and goes, man, bro, you getting paid on that? On Devaroli's book or what? And I went, no, I said, it hasn't been published. I don't think it hasn't been published. Because last I had heard was Simon & Schuster couldn't publish it. Like they needed a year to publish it. And they didn't want to wait that long. I was like, no, no, it's not. He said, what are you talking about? And he opens up Ocean Drive and there's a picture of Deborah Rowley at a book signing with like 100, 200 copies of my book behind him. And he's signing books.
Wow.
What? So, oh yeah. Well, here's the thing. Nobody cares if you take advantage of an inmate. Like the police don't care. The courts don't care. Nobody cares. I mean, I know guys that literally got arrested, went to prison. Their next door neighbors went into their houses and just stole everything. And then when they actually filed police reports and everything, police wouldn't even look into it. Well, you're some guy that just got arrested and you got 15 years and anything you get, you deserve. So
wow.
I did end up filing a lawsuit against him just before I got out of prison. I filed a lawsuit against Devaroli, literary agent, their company, and Warner Brothers. But from his perspective, what ultimately happened was while Devaroli was out, Warner Brothers actually got a hold of the manuscript. And according to the lawsuit, they used it to rewrite the screenplay, according to Devaroli's lawsuit, not Warner Brothers, of course. They don't disagree they got a hold of the manuscript. They're just saying we used it so that we didn't have any overlapping scenes. And it was all BS. But point is they said, ultimately, Devaroli said they used it to rewrite the movie script and that his stuff was in the movie. And he sued Warner Brothers. And then I sued him. And it just went back and forth. And then eventually when I got out, we settled.
Oh, that's an unexpected.
Well, I don't want to go on and on about it.
I'm glad that you settled because that makes me feel better that you.
Kidding me? We text each other now. I mean, of course.
Really? That's so cool.
I'm like, hey, you got to come on this podcast. And he's like, I don't know. My wife, my family, they'll flip right out. We're trying to make this die down.
But you got to get him as a guest. So wait, tell me a couple of the other favorite stories that you wrote about.
So, well, once this is happening, people see me walking around with a pen and a pad, following these other inmates, walking around saying, well, then what happened? What color was the car?
Right.
Was that the Camaro? No, I got a new car by then. So I'm jotting down stuff and asking questions. People start realizing what I'm doing. And when it really took off was there was a kid named Douglas Dodd, and he was following me around. He said, I know you wrote Devaroli's story. I want you to write my story. And I was like, well, I'm writing another story right now. It was on a guy named Marcus Schrinker in 2009. He was about to be arrested for securities fraud. And he took his private airplane up and he called in a distress signal, said the windshield had spider cracked and had imploded and he was bleeding. And then he jumped out of the plane trying to fake his own death. The plane was supposed to go out over the Gulf and crash in the ocean and the body got washed away. Well, when he opened up the side door, the drag pulled on the plane and he ran out of gas before it got to the Gulf and it crashed a couple miles short of the Gulf and the windshield had not imploded. And so it was pretty obvious, a lot of this doesn't make sense.
Right.
And so they found him like 3 days later. And he's been everywhere. He's been on American Greed. He's been on Dateline. He was 2020. I mean, he was on think about the sensationalism of that. I mean, if you look him up, he's everywhere. So anyway, I saw him and he came up to me and he had come up to me and asked me if I'd write his memoir. And I said, sure. So I was writing his memoir and his story. And then as I was finishing that, Doug Dodd came up to me and asked me to write his. And I was like, I didn't really want to write Dodd's because it was a drug story. And I kind of told myself I didn't want to do drug stories. But it was so interesting because it was a group of high school wrestlers that were selling oxycodone or Oxycontin, whatever, oxys. And then after high school, they all got, well, not all of them, one of them stayed. Doug and another guy stayed here and three of them went up and they all got scholarships. And so they ended up having this kind of, they would ship pills up and they would sell them in the colleges and they'd ship the money back and it went back and forth. And it was kind of an interesting story. And it was, most drug stories are like, it's, African-American based, let's say. But these were a bunch of what appeared to be clean cut white guys, right? They were, they were trailer trash. Yeah, but they all grew up in like trailer parks and they're driving like, I remember one time. I said to Doug, I said something about, I had put down that they were poor white trash struggling to be lower middle class. And I said, that's what family was. And he got upset. I don't like the way you said that and this and that. You make it. You said here that I grew up in the trailer parks of Hudson, Florida. And I was like, I mean, Doug, you did grow up in the trailer. No, they weren't trailer parks. I was like, Doug, this story right here, you told me, right? I go, where were you guys living?
Well, we were living in a double wide.
And this story here where you got robbed this time, where was that take place? Where did that take place?
Well, there was a single wide trailer and a rundown, trailer.
What about this one? What about when you guys had that party? Where was that? Oh, that was my buddy. He had a double wide. Okay. What about this one? Everybody was double wide. I was like, so how am I wrong? I said, look, you need to embrace that. Like, I would embrace white trash. I would tell everybody I was white trash. I said, the shock value alone, you owning up to it is what makes it amazing. I said, I would never shy away because, and I don't see it as a bad thing.
Very like Eminem 8 Mile.
You have to own where you come from. You have to. You should never be ashamed of that. Well, listen, by the time I was done writing it, we were walking and somebody goes, Doug, man, so what's your book going to be? But like, bro, I didn't even know you really had a story. You said, man, I'm just a poor kid that grew up in the trailer parks of Hudson, Florida. Basically it's just me and a bunch of other white trash guys selling pills. It was just, mm-hmm. He looked at me and we both just died laughing. But he explained it in such a way and he was really honest about it. And I loved that. And I told him, look, if I can get you had no media attention. So if I can get you into, I don't know, I said, maybe some magazine or something, Rolling Stone, something. I said, I'll do the story. I'll write the memoir. But I said, I'm going to write a synopsis. So I wrote like a 9,000 word synopsis, sent it off to about 6 or 7 different reporters that wrote for like GQ and Esquire and Rolling Stone. Two or three of them answered me. Two of them said they wanted to do the story, but it was going to take them 6 months before they could get to it. One guy said he could jump on it right away. I said, okay, well, that's it. So he took the story and he got it into Rolling Stone magazine. And it was supposed to be from Guy Lawson, which was his name, Guy Lawson, Douglas Dodd, and Matthew Cox. And so I was going to have a byline in Rolling Stone magazine. It was just amazing. And about 2-3 weeks before that came out, he said the editor of Rolling Stone magazine did not want to have my name or Doug's name on it. But they were, don't worry, he was going to mention me in the article. And I got super upset. Like I was upset. I was angry. He was like, I mean, that's just the way it is. There's nothing you can do. So it came out and New Line Cinema bought it or optioned it. And of course, we had an agreement with him that if it was optioned, and I knew about options because Devaroli's story had been optioned. And my literary agent, we had talked about optioning my story. And so we optioned it. And that money helped me do a website and kind of jumpstart writing other guys' stories. Then I wrote another story called Bent. But listen, when it came out in Rolling Stone magazine, guys were just lining up. You got to hear my story. You got to hear my story. You got to hear my, you got to talk to my Sally. Oh, there's a new guy just came on the compound. It's amazing.
So wait, I just have to stop because this is so amazing to me that you're this guy in prison for bank fraud, basically, and other things. But that's really why you're there. You're not a memoirist. You're not an author. You're not a writer.
But I have access.
But you have access. But you come in to prison and you get this idea because people give it to you to write your own story. And then you get the idea, or you not even get the idea, you offer your help to people who don't know how to write their stories, who also have good stories. And then you start writing other people's stories because that's what they want you to do, and you have this gift. But you also have this access outside of prison. I mean, I'm part of two writers' groups. They would love the access you're describing to like reporters at Rolling Stone and blah, blah, blah. I know you had time. You were able to do that.
Yeah, this is funny. I'll tell you this. This is because there's a couple things that I literally, thank God this isn't Zoom, because literally I cannot tell the story without tearing up every time I tell it. So I was writing a kid's story. Keep in mind, I have very little money. I have almost no money. And look, when we sold that option and I got a check, I can't cash a check. So we sent it, my own family didn't want to cash the check. They were like, where did this come from? They were all like scared. I was like, what do you do? This is the only legitimate money I've made in 15 years. You don't want to cash the check?
Sounds like I had a lot of help, but it's a lot of phone calls and it's a lot of emails over and over again. But what, and I'll give you an example. So one, my research is done by the Freedom of Information Act. Plus, these guys have copies of their paperwork usually. So that's amazing access. I get to order the Freedom of Information Act, and because I'm indigent, they have to provide it for free. I also get these guys to order most of their transcripts and their indictments and that sort of thing. So, or they already, if they don't already have it, like Deborah Rowley, he literally had 15 or 20 boxes of documents. He still thought he was going to win his, his case. And even though he's guilty of sin. And so I remember one time, and this is an example, like where I was just, I had no money. And I wrote this guy, I'd written this story about a credit card counterfeiter who grew up homeless on the streets of Miami, was abandoned by his mom at 13, grew up homeless on the streets of Miami, continued to go to high school, ended up getting a degree in graphic design, and ended up selling about $3.5 million in counterfeit credit cards to the Russian mob. He was a counterfeiter. So I was trying to get documents on him, and I'd gotten a whole bunch of police reports and Freedom of Information Act, and he had gotten out of prison by that point, and I was trying to get his sentencing transcripts, and he had basically disappeared again. So I wanted to finish the memoir, and I wrote a letter to the court reporter who had taken down the transcripts at his sentencing. Because a lot of times the U.S. attorneys will say really, you know, horrible things at your sentencing. And I wanted those. I wanted, you know, they'll make you sound horrible, but a lot of times they say great sensational lines. And so I wanted that. And so I wrote her a letter and said, look, here's what's going on. How much is it? She came back and she said, okay, you know, it's like, I forget what it was, $100 or something. And I came back and I went, listen, I'm not using this for the purposes of legal work. Doesn't have to be certified, doesn't have to be perfect. But I'm writing a book. And I said a true crime memoir on this guy. And I said, and that probably sounds silly, but it's how I pass my time. And if you could find it in your heart to give me some kind of a discount, you could do it. If it takes you a month and a half, that's fine, whatever. Anything you could help me with would be appreciated.
Right. And you had time.
I'm using what I've got.
Yeah.
So instead of her charging $3.50 a page, you know, I said, could you charge me, you know, $1 a page or somewhere in between something? So about a week and a half later, I get the transcripts of the sentencing, and she just sent them to me. And she said, I wish you the best of luck, and I hope that this works out for you. And I mean, I just couldn't believe it. I just didn't catch a lot of breaks. Like I had, you know, this was passing my time, but I didn't catch breaks. And I wrote her a letter back saying, listen, you absolutely rock. I thank you so much. You have no idea. To you, I know this is nothing, but to me, this is huge. Like that $100 is a massive amount of money in prison. So I used, and the transcripts were great. They were great. Like literally I found out like you've got the judge saying how many, he didn't know how many credit cards he was caught with. He was like, I don't know. It was 100. Maybe it was, I don't know. I forget. Judge says, looks like you were arrested with 300 credit cards. You know, there were all these little things that the judge verified, that things I couldn't verify. How do you verify that some kid was homeless? It's almost impossible. All the juvenile records are sealed. You know, how do I prove that he actually got his degree from the Art Institute? They're not going to give me anything. The judge says it. The judge said all that stuff. It was just like awesome. So
you were mining for gold.
Right.
Yeah.
I ended up getting a police report one time that was attached to a missing juvenile report was attached to it. And it specifically said he had run away from a teen homeless facility that he had told me about. So it's like, and it said homeless teen. And that was like, wow. Like I didn't have anything that really proved, I believed him, but I didn't have anything that said that. And here's some document from 10 years earlier that just happened to come in by accident because his juvenile warrant was attached to it.
It's really interesting because what you're talking about is like kind of part historian, part reporter, part, you know, writer. And you're using all those different aspects to put together a story. In this case, it's for you after the fact because he's no longer in your presence. And you can put all those pieces together by using actual documents, right. And which is so cool. And it's very much in the vein of, you look at like those mystery writers and true crime. Right. I mean, that's what you're doing. And Scotty just gave me the sign. I have to start winding up because we're almost out of time. I have two more things I really want to ask you about. This is a quote from The Atlantic. I forgot the reporter's name, but...
Rachel Monroe.
Rachel Monroe. She says, last April, I received an odd email from a man named Matthew Cox, and it says, I am an inmate at the Coleman Federal Correctional Complex in Florida. He wrote, I'm also a true crime writer. He had 1 year left on his sentence and was attempting to develop a body of work that would allow me to exit prison with a new career. He included a story about a fellow inmate who had been ensnared in a complicated currency trading scam, hoping that I'd write about it for The Atlantic. And so what I really enjoyed about this is because it's telling a story in its own. You're nearing the end of your prison sentence when you write this, and you're wondering how you're going to support yourself when you're released, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So tell me about the restrictions that you'd be placed under once you're released regarding to how you can support yourself, because I know you couldn't do anything in finance, right?
Right. I'm not allowed to work in finance, in real estate, development, and, you know, that limits me. That basically says anything I have previous experience in, I'm not allowed to do. So, you know, what do you do? And what I decided once I'd been writing for a year or two, I decided that I enjoyed it so much. By that point, I was, you know, dead broke in prison, scraping together these stories, but I'd never been happier. So I'm in prison, happy, actually worried about getting out of prison, not looking forward to it. And thinking that I was going to get out and I was going to continue to try and push, I was going to start pushing these stories. Now that I'm out, is I thought, once I'm out, I'll push the stories. And I thought, if I push them when I'm out, you know, how cheaply can I live? Can I live in, I'll live in someone's spare room. I'll take the bus. This is what I'm thinking. I'm down to nothing. I'm willing to stay that way because I was so overwhelmingly happy. And I knew getting out and making a bunch of money wasn't going to make me happy because I'd had a bunch of money and it was never enough. And I just become this greedy, you know, psychopath. And now I'm in prison and I'm thrilled doing this. And so that's what I was trying to do, was I was trying to get out of prison and turn the stories into, get them made into documentaries and films or whatever. And if I had to scrape by to do that, then that's what I was going to do. And so, yeah, I was very concerned about how I was going to make my living. You know, and I just figured, yeah, here's what I'll do, yeah, is I can work a minimum wage job and I can pay my bills. And I don't, if as long as I keep my bills down to nothing. Now, what ended up happening was vastly different. I mean, I got out and I did a couple of, you know, some guys wanted me to do a podcast. I did a podcast and it took off. And, you know, I started making money doing various things, all things that I didn't think you could make money. And I published, you know, self-published. And that's making me money, and the podcasts are making me money, and I'm painting's making me money, I'm getting speaking engagements. So like all these weird things that I didn't know what a podcast was. You know, I literally was asking guys, new guys that came in off the street, what's a podcast? Everybody keeps telling me I got to do a podcast.
Well, of course.
And they tried to explain it, and I still didn't understand until I actually listened to the podcast Serial.
I got to tell you, you actually weren't that far behind. There are a lot of people that I know today who are still like, what's a podcast?
Oh, yeah, I've heard of them.
Right. But they have no idea how to access them. They think it's the radio. So you are far ahead of some people. You said something to me. I hope it's okay to say this. Because you said that you told your parole officer, if all this doesn't work out, you're going to commit a massive fraud and then leave the country.
Yeah, that wasn't halfway out. She said to me, she goes, because this is after, she said, well, look, you know, you're on probation once for $500,000. I was like, right. She goes, then while you're on probation, you committed another, like, between 15 to 55 million, depending on who you believe. And she's, you know, it was at least, you know, and there's still $6 million missing. So they're like, there's still 6 million. You owe 6 million. We know it's 15. You pled guilty to 15. So she said, you've been in trouble and you kept getting in trouble. She goes, but all that's behind you. And I remember I rocked my head like, meh. And she goes, well, what does that mean? And I went, well, I mean, it means that if in a year I'm going to get out and I'm going to bust my ass for a year. And she goes, well, what happens after a year? I go, if after a year I'm riding the bus, I live in someone's spare room, and I said, I'm, and I'm basically headed to being homeless, something like that. And she goes, yeah. I went, I'm going to commit a massive fraud and I'm going to leave the United States because that's where I fucked up last time. And she did a look. You know what's so funny about her? She was pretty cool. She looked at me. She goes, yeah, I'm not as shocked by that as you might think. Like, really? Because usually that one shocks people. And she's like,
eh. Right.
She goes, well, let's hope it doesn't work, go that route. And I said, well, let's hope so. And a year later, I thought she forgot all about it. Literally a year later, in July of this year, she goes, so do you remember a year ago? And I'm like, are you still thinking about that? She's like, well, yeah.
Well,
it was a pretty
pretty bold statement.
It stuck with me.
I might lose my job if that happens.
Well, you know, what's so funny is I was like, listen, I was upset. I was angry. I was scared. I said, I would be a fool not to continue in along the path that I am going right now. I was terrified at the time. And I said, now I'm not. And she was like, okay, good.
Well, I just thank you for that. And I just got to say a couple of things that I love about your story. I love that you chose the possibility of happiness and you're continuing to follow that path and that you recognize that money didn't make you happy and that if you can be happy doing this and support yourself, then that's all you'll need, which is amazing. And then on your website, Inside True Crime, which everybody should go and click on and see these amazing stories and your art, which is beautiful, by the way. I love your art. It reminds me of a couple of different artists and in prison. So I'm assuming you started it afterward?
Well, I have a degree in fine arts, but yes.
Oh, you do?
But the issue is it's expensive to paint in prison. Yeah.
That's right. You said that. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it's beautiful art, but what really struck me was that the stories that you tell, and tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems like you've set it up so the person whose stories you tell, they have their own IP owned on your site. Is that correct?
Yes. Each one of the subjects, I had sign a life rights agreement with me. So their life rights, their IP is connected to the story, you know.
Right, which is intellectual property.
You know, because of course my fear is I get out, I get up to a bunch of publicity, and then someone goes directly to them and says, hey, let's write a screenplay, let's do this. And then what happens to me?
Right,
You know, and that happens. And I just said, look, I'm just not going to do that. You have to sign this over. And of course these guys have 5 years left, 10 years left, 20 years left. You know, you got a great story. Nothing's going to happen with it, though. You can't write it. I'll write it. We'll work out an agreement. You know, if I sell it, you know, we'll split it. And I always tell them, look, there's a good chance I get out, I put it on a website and it never goes anywhere. But you know what? It's more than you got. It's a better chance than you have right now. And they were all, you know, there was only one or two that there was an issue. Very seldom was there ever an issue where someone didn't want to sign. And this is the thing. Okay, you don't have to sign. But if I get, it also works like this. It's really protecting you against me. Because if I get out, while you're incarcerated and I get some publicity and someone offers me, says, hey, oh, wow, I read the story. It's amazing. Let's turn this into a film. I can sell it. You don't get anything. You voluntarily spoke with me, allowed me to write the story, and I published it. I own it.
And that's what I was thinking when I saw that it was the double protection. And I figured it was really, it was kind of profound after your experience with Devaroli that you were not going to let that happen again.
Yeah, I mean, what kind of a con man would I be if I didn't see all the angles? Well, you know, and you know, it's the interesting thing too is it's funny because when I talk to these production companies, they're like, "No, it's a great story. It's this, it's that. I wonder this, I wonder that," and they start talking, and then they're like, "You know, I wonder if we could talk to the guy." And I'm like, "Oh, absolutely. He'll talk to you. It's in his best interest to talk to you." What do you mean? I have the intellectual property. Like, he signed. Here's the 2-page document he signed. His life rights are attached. So now they know. He's not going to sue us. Like if the movie comes, not like Devaroli sued, you know, a lot of these guys end up suing. You go out and you make a movie about me. Technically, if it was publicly available information or they voluntarily gave me the information knowing I'm a reporter and I publish it, I own it. Well, a lot of these guys, then next thing you know, they don't realize when they're talking to the reporter, this may happen. Then suddenly they find out, hey, guess what? They're making American Gangster. And it's the Frank Lucas story. It's my story. Guess what? Frank Lucas doesn't get anything. He's, hey, that's not right. You came, you talked to me, you wrote this book on me. You're not going to give me anything? So what happens is, in that case, they actually went and they said, look, we're going to give you this just out of the kindness of our heart. Not because they know he's going to sue, you know, and it's a problem. It's going to cost us $500,000 or $1 million. And legal fees. So let's just go and work out an agreement. But they don't have to. In many cases, they just don't. And so when you explain that to these guys, people think every time they see a movie made about somebody, they think, oh, well, that guy got, he got a bunch of money.
He came up, right? Not necessarily. It's just so cool. I've never talked to anybody like you before. Never talked to anybody that has anywhere near your story.
The only one in the room.
I can't wait for your own podcast to come out. You are the only one in the room.
Yes, you are.
Hey, tell me, Matt, where can people find you?
Let's see. I started a YouTube channel about 6 months ago. It's called Matt Cox and Inside True Crime. My paintings are on another YouTube channel called Cox Pop Art. And my website is InsideTrueCrime.com. And all in every caption everywhere is, you know, my email address. You can actually contact me through the website also. I literally just started even messing with it because it's, you know, it's so foreign to me.
Yeah.
No, I'm not great at it.
You're doing podcasts first. That's good. And then you'll get to social media after
baby
that. Baby steps. Thank you. Thank you, Matt. Thank you so much for this. This is enlightening and fascinating. I really appreciate it.
Laura Scott, I appreciate it too. Any chance I have to talk about myself for an hour?
Right.
Absolutely.
It's
all about it.
Thank you for listening to The Only One in the Room. Please join us each Tuesday and Sunday for an incredible brand new Only One interview. And every Friday for On My Nightstand, where I'll be reading something that I love. If you have an Only One story you'd like to share or a piece of writing you'd like to submit, please send it to theonlyonepod@gmail.com. From all of us at The Only One in the Room, we wish you dopeness, health, and prosperity.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. Wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to season one, we are thrilled to announce the launch of season two. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make season two even more memorable together.